Met Philips.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I represent the appellants in this matter. What we have before us is an unprecedented and quite extraordinary punishment that was inflicted by the Department of Health and Human Services arising out of a criminal conviction based on a guilty plea to a misdemeanor misbranding charge. Operating under the corporate responsibility officer theory. That is, there is no evidence in this record that any of the three defendants, appellants in this matter, had any knowledge or acted with any intention with respect to the distribution or sale of OxyContin on behalf of Purdue Pharma. That led to an appropriate conviction under the circumstances, to be sure, given the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Park. But the fundamental question then becomes, under what circumstances in a statute that says that if you are convicted of a criminal offense consisting of a misdemeanor relating to a fraud, whether that is language that invites the government then to come in and say, to be sure, misdemeanor misbranding on its face would not constitute a misdemeanor relating to a fraud, because misdemeanor misbranding can relate to any of a thousand different things, but instead that we can look behind at the overall gestalt of this particular arrangement and say, well, there was fraud involved with respect to the underlying corporation, and therefore it's reasonable to attach this kind of a penalty under these circumstances. Courts looking at language like this in other circumstances, in the immigration context in particular, but even under the Armed Criminal Control Act, have consistently adopted the view that the appropriate way to approach these arguments is to say, what do we look at as a category of offenses, and does this fall within the category of offense? And to my mind, the Sixth Circuit's decision in Castaneda is as clean and clear an analog to this one as you can find, where the court in the Sixth Circuit said, look, the misprision of a felony is, to be sure, potentially in some sense related to the distribution of narcotics if what you don't disclose is the distribution of narcotics, but it is not by its nature necessarily connected in any meaningful way, and therefore the in related to requirement is not satisfied in that context. It seems to us, Your Honors, to follow the logic of that into this case, you would say that there is a break between the actual offense for which they are charged and the ultimate punishment that's been invoked in this circumstance.
Is it unfair to say that that is an ambiguous statutory language?
I don't believe it's ambiguous, Judge Sentelle. My own view is that the statute seems pretty plain, and in particular, because the language that I've always been struck by is this notion of criminal offense consisting of a misdemeanor. Not just simply a conviction relating to, but it's the previous language.
Too free of ambiguity.
Right, but that's why I think, it's the language criminal offense consisting of a misdemeanor that seems to me
but
to
the
most.
But doesn't end there. It continues with the word a misdemeanor related to.
Right, to be sure. And that's why I would say.
If it ended with a misdemeanor, you'd be in worse trouble, wouldn't you? Consisting of a misdemeanor.
Yeah, no, then I would be done.
Yeah,
then we would be arguing about 12 years versus some other lesser.
You related to.
Right.
And isn't related to a fairly broad usage that's subject to ambiguity?
Well, Judge Sentelle, I think it's, to be sure, broad usage. I think the question is if you conclude in the first instance that the relating to language means what relates to what? So we know the back part's easy. It's fraud and scienter-related offenses. The first, then, is what is the nature of the offense that must relate to it? And it seems to me in that context, if you're talking about aiding and abetting, if you're talking about conspiracy, if you were talking about other kinds of offenses which in their nature relate to other kinds of offenses, then it seems to me that's what Congress had in mind. And, of course, Congress clearly has to use language that's a little broader, certainly than the misdemeanor language that it could if it truncated this, because it wants to get at state law crimes, and obviously state laws aren't characterized in exactly the same way as the federal law. So that's the reason for the relating to.
The most salient misdemeanor, assuming Congress looks at the whole sort of array of medical assistance federal provisions, wouldn't this misdemeanor be the most salient of, perhaps the only, such provision?
Well, the problem I have with that, Judge Williams, is...
I mean, it's a little odd to, in this federal statute, to find the meaning for misdemeanor in a bunch of somewhat obscure state statutes.
Except that it's pretty clear that Congress meant in this context in the same way that it means in exclusion cases in other contexts, immigration and otherwise, to expand beyond federal criminal activity. So it clearly has an excuse to do that.
I don't think those are out, but it's a little odd for the, as I say, the most salient. What seems, and maybe I'm wrong on that.
Well, I would think that the most salient would be notions of aiding and abetting and conspiracy.
Aiding and abetting and conspiracy are not usually misdemeanors.
Well, it could be under state law, Judge Sintel.
Conceivably, it could be under state law, but as Judge Williams suggests, isn't Congress more likely in terms when they're legislating with respect to a federal regulatory scheme to be speaking in terms of the federal law and only incidentally of the state law?
Well, I wouldn't
really
necessarily take issue with that one way or the other, but I think if the aim of the statute were really to say that what we really want to deal with in this context is this particular misdemeanor, then you would have attached the exclusion provision to that particular misdemeanor rather than
that. But as Judge Williams suggests, this would seem to be the most salient, the most relevant one to what Congress was doing. You don't know, I don't think, I certainly don't know, what state misdemeanors might even be involved. I think it's more typical that if you're talking about aiding and abetting fraud, it's going to be a felony under state law.
It may well be,
I don't think you're going to find... You find no evidence that Congress really had state law in mind when it's doing this.
Right, but the flip side of this, Judge Sintel, is that at some point that it cannot be that it's every crime, every misdemeanor, is swept into this. It has to be related to a fraud.
Related to that list, which includes...
Right, it seems to me there are two ways to look at the related to component of this. It's got to be related to because it is in the nature of the offense.
There are two ways to look at it. Haven't you come back to my original question? Doesn't it have ambiguity?
No, there are two ways to look at it, both of which I win.
Therefore, it's not ambiguous?
No, I win on both of these ways of looking at it. The one way to look at it is you do it on a categorical basis, and you say that misbranding under a corporate responsibility theory is simply not the kind of offense that is under any circumstances related to fraud. The other way to look at it is that you're examining these, and that contrasts to aiding and abetting and other offenses. The other way to look at it is that there has to be some form of a scienter requirement, that the one common element of the related to second half of the statute all deal with notions of scienter, and therefore you have to have at least some kind of intent embedded in the misdemeanor. And the one thing we know we don't have in this case is nothing involving scienter. And that's what makes, I think, the notion of imposing this penalty over and above the penalty that has already been imposed on the defendants.
Your inference about scienter being the sine qua non, that it is an element common to all of the listed offenses? Is that where it comes from?
I believe it is.
What about other financial misconduct?
I would read the other financial misconduct as keeping company with the other provisions. I don't think it means other financial misconduct for which there is no intent. I would argue that would require a willfulness or knowledge or some kind of a requirement of intent beyond what we have in our particular case, where there is not, what is conceded.
You would apply an intent in that one in order to get a list consistently containing intent, so you could apply an intent in this one.
Well, to be sure that there is a certain circularity to that, Judge Sintel. On the other hand, it would seem to me, if you took this out of this issue and you were just reading that list of offenses on the back end, I don't think you would assume that they meant any financial wrongdoing that lacks the scienter that all of the others seem clearly to embrace. So, I do think that's a reasonable way to interpret this particular provision. So I would say that either because of the lack of the scienter or because of the nature of the offense, the court should hold that the exclusion statute in this case doesn't apply. If you don't accept that particular position, then it seems to me the second part of the argument is that the 12-year exclusion under these circumstances, which is effectively the death penalty to the professional lives of these individuals, all of whom have spent their entire careers in the health field and who are now barred from participation in any federal health care program for a period of 12 years, that's a period that is 3 to 4 times longer than others who have been excluded from programs for conduct that was demonstrably more culpable than the corporate responsibility misdemeanor for which they pled guilty under these circumstances.
What's our standard of review on that, Mr. Phillips?
Well, on the question, the ordinary standard of review is there has to be substantial evidence in the record to support the decision of the secretary in this case. The answer to the question of why there is no substantial evidence is sort of twofold. The first one is really actually it's also inconsistent with law, because the regulation that allows you to look to aggravating circumstances defines aggravating circumstances solely in terms of acts and not in terms of omissions. And it is undisputed in the record of this case that there were no acts taken by the defendants in this particular case. There may have been acts taken by the corporation, but those were all done without the knowledge and certainly without the approval of the defendants under these circumstances. So at a minimum, I think this court would have to conclude that there is no basis for applying the aggravating circumstances at all. And so there you're back to the benchmark, which is the three-year benchmark. And then you would begin to look at the mitigating circumstances. And in that particular context here, we're talking about a situation where the secretary has conceded that there are, in fact, mitigating circumstances. The defendants in this case adopted extraordinary efforts to assist law enforcement.
I expect them to say that they took into account those mitigating circumstances. There's been, what, two reductions already?
The reduction from 20 to 15 was based on that particular mitigating circumstance. But of course, if I'm correct that there are no aggravating circumstances regulation doesn't apply, then you're terminated at that point and you start at 3. If you made a similar 20-25% reduction on that, then the exclusion would drop even below that under these circumstances. So I think, as I say, my first line of defense here would be that there are no aggravating circumstances, and then you probably ought to vacate and remand to apply the mitigating.
For want of an act, is that why?
Right, because the statute, I mean, the regulation is very clear, and obviously this is a statute that has many references to acts or omissions. The regulations have many references to acts or omissions. And here's a situation where it specifically targets and says for acts, which makes sense, candidly, because where are sources of aggravation going to come from? Or what are the aggravating circumstances? They're going to come from specific acts taken by the defendant in particular cases. Those didn't exist in this particular case.
I mean, if somebody is sort of willfully ignorant, grossly negligent, those could be omissions.
They could be omissions, and I don't mean to suggest that HHS couldn't change the regulation to say, well, we've revisited the issue and concluded that something more than acts ought to be a basis on which to attach aggravating consequences. But as the regulation exists currently in its plain language, it refers solely to acts, and under those circumstances, it seems to me quite reasonable to hold them to the language. And if they want to change it, then that's fine. Let them change it prospectively through the normal notice and comment process, and then we can have an argument about whether that's an appropriate application of the statute in a separate proceeding.
A parallel issue. Didn't the common law just move from affirmative misrepresentations to the defendants being silent in a context where one would have been expected to speak up if the truth were as it were? And with that background, could not act be reasonably understood to include omission?
Well, I mean,
assuming the omission is sufficiently culpable.
Well, I think if you were dealing with a common law situation and the question was, could you interpret act under those circumstances to apply in a particular way, that would be one thing. But we're talking about a statutory context where Congress is not operating against that background and is specifically identifying both acts and omissions as the basis upon which consequences flow. And it is in that context where the HHS has decided to trigger the aggravating circumstances exclusively to acts themselves. In that situation, it seems to me, you essentially write out of the statute the references to omissions, which are clearly aimed precisely at Judge Williams, what you're describing there as a basis upon which certain common law consequences would have traditionally flowed. And Congress has simply done nothing more than
this is the regulation.
This is a regulation, to be sure, which is why, as I said to Judge Ginsburg, HHS is free to change it. It may have to defend it under those circumstances. All I was suggesting is it's understandable why they might restrict it to acts as opposed to make it acts or omissions under these circumstances. And in any event, the language is sufficiently plain that the court should reach that, should conclude that it, that there are no aggravating circumstances. The final point I would make with respect to the failings of the agency in this context is the question of causation. I think it's important to recognize that this is a derivative action. This, there was no effort by the IG, or by, excuse me, by the department to litigate, to investigate, to determine whether there had been a problem. In this context, the U.S. attorney, millions of pages of documents, hundreds of interviews, there's not a shred of evidence of any loss that's directed at this particular conduct of
except
the specific
the fact
defendants.
Of restitution. Mm-hmm.
Except that restitution is not a measure of loss, at least not inherently.
Not a measure of it, but it's certainly an indication of it, isn't it? That there was a loss. I'm sorry. That there was a loss and that, what was the restitution, $160 million?
Right, except
that
the
was
problem
not an
with
inconsiderable
that,
loss.
Well, except that's the restitution.
There was not a less than $5,000 loss.
But Judge Ginsburg, we all, the reality of these situations is you're chasing the defending corporation with a potential criminal conviction, which is effectively the death penalty for it, as we know from Arthur Anderson, and the settlement.
Well, was that the case in Purdue's fate?
Oh, of course it would have been their fate had they had they gone to trial and been convicted of the, of certain charges. Of course it would have been the end of it.
But in fact, they were convicted. By agreement, by plea agreement.
Right, by the plea agreement that took them out of the way, that prevented them from having been banned from being able to continue to provide the medicines that they've been providing for years and years and years. That's a risk nobody can take. That's a bet nobody can take. And so to assume that any amount of money paid by the corporation under these circumstances necessarily reflects loss beggars the
not
record.
An assumption. That was designated restitution in the agreement by the company, right?
Yes, it was designated by, but not by the defendants. But
we're not assuming that there was a loss. We're seeing evidence that the company admitted there had been a loss. Now, granted, the magnitude of this restitution may have been influenced by external factors, but when the balance is it greater than 5,000 or is it 5,000 or greater, and it's 160 million,
just until I understand your comments, this reaction to that, all I can say is that the record in this case before the U.S. attorney and everything that's been created says there's not a shred of evidence of loss whatsoever.
It was loss necessary or only a likelihood of loss?
Likelihood of loss would only have applied in, as under their own regulations in circumstances where the attempt is made and truncated, where there has been no payment made. And here, a payment was made. Mm-hmm. Under those circumstances, they have to bear the burden of demonstrating actual loss that was caused by the actions of the defendants in this case, and they did not do that, Your Honor.
I'm not sure I followed that limitation that you just suggested. I'm looking at 42 CFR 1001.201B.
Right, that talks about it.
I.
Right.
The acts resulting in the conviction or similar acts that caused or reasonably could have been expected to cause a financial loss of $5,000
or
more.
If you look at page 53 of our brief, Judge Ginsburg, we specifically reference the analysis by the agency of how that particular provision applies, because it was a matter of some controversy whether or not it would apply to every situation and thereby eliminate the need to prove actual loss in cases where there's been actual payment. And the commission and the agency, the secretary, in adopting the regulation, said that it would not be applied in situation except in situations where it was discovered before payment was made. So that's what that applies to. If there's been no payment, but that there is a risk of loss, then you can apply the aggravating circumstance. If there's been a payment, then they have an obligation to prove actual loss. That Judge Sintel, on this record, they did not do. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, Your Honor, unless there are further questions.
Seeing no questions, we'll give you back a little more than your balance, actually. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Assistant United States Attorney Robin Merriweather, representing the appellees. The decision to exclude the Purdue executives was consistent with the statute and based on a reasonable interpretation and application of the agency's regulations. There are three issues that have been addressed here. The first is the reasonableness and correctness of the agency's interpretation of sections B1 and B3. The second is the agency's interpretation and application of the regulations, which set the aggravating factors. And the third is the presence of substantial evidence from the criminal proceedings to support the aggravating factors that were applied. I'd like to begin with the text of the statute, if I may. The subsection 1320A7B1 allows the secretary to exclude, at her discretion, an individual that has been convicted of a criminal offense consisting of a misdemeanor relating to fraud. Subsection B3 correspondingly allows exclusion when the conviction relates to the unlawful distribution of a controlled substance. The appeals board, departmental appeals board, for many years has interpreted that to require that there be a common sense connection or a nexus, and that's consistent with the ordinary meaning of relating to, between the offense.
But you're doing something sort of tricky here. We have misdemeanor, which is a purely legal term, a concept of a type of crime. And then we have, on the other end of the relating to, we have a bunch of, certainly the first three appear to be crimes, the fourth, it's questionable, fifth, who knows. At any rate, it seems sort of odd to read that as misdemeanor, the facts of which in the current conviction relate to somebody's fraud, theft, embezzlement, et cetera, et cetera. That seems to me a sort of arcane reading of statutory language.
Well, there are two responses to that, Your Honor. First, we do not, I don't quite agree with your articulation of what we're saying the statute means.
Isn't that what your formula, nexus, really conceals?
No. There are really two issues. One is, what does relating to mean? And our position is that requires a common sense connection or nexus. And the second question is, what must relate to what? And our position is, we already know one half of the relation, which is what's articulated in the statute, fraud, other financial misconduct. And the question is, can we consider the circumstances of the conviction when we decide?
The circumstances of, I mean, that in itself is a step, but you go farther. You go to the circumstances relating to the whole thing that led to it and other people's fraud, theft, embezzlement,
well,
whatever.
Well, not so much in this case, Your Honor. The board has consistently for many years held that we can look at the conviction, which might be from a jury verdict. In this case, it came from a plea agreement. And in this case, it's not, the Purdue executives suggest that this is all about what other people do, but the Purdue executives themselves had a responsibility and obligation under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to prevent fraud.
You've got that in the misdemeanor, right? You've got them on the guilty plea for the misdemeanor, but then you've got to relate the misdemeanor to these other things.
Yes, and here the misdemeanor, well, here the offense that they were convicted of is a failure to prevent fraud. And a failure to prevent fraud has a connection or nexus to fraud. And in terms of whether we take a categorical approach or a circumstantial approach, I would direct the court to a Supreme Court case, Niwan versus Holder, which we did not cite in our briefs, but is cited in one of the authorities that we cited. And that's at 129 Supreme Court, 2294.
Give that again, please.
Yes, 129 S Court 2294.
Thank you.
And in that case, which arises in the immigration context, which is the circumstance, the context in which on which the appellants rely, the Supreme Court noted that a reference in the statute to a crime or an offense may mean the generic categorical approach that appellants advocate in this case, or it might refer to the acts in which the offender engaged. We would submit that, in other words, there is a categorical approach or there is a circumstance-driven approach. And when a statute, in that case, the question was whether a reference in the immigration deportation laws regarding an offense involving fraud or deceit that had a loss over a certain threshold, the question was, does the loss over a certain threshold come from the criminal code definition of the offense or the crime, or does it come from the circumstances? And the Supreme Court held that you can consider the circumstances. We're not saying that there's only one way to interpret the statutory language.
In that case, is it other other parties who took this amount up over the, whatever the threshold was?
Well, that issue wasn't really addressed. The question was, what's the analytical construct that you apply to determine whether there's a connection in the first place?
If you're doing the circumstances, it seems to me that there are the two steps in that. One is the circumstances fairly specifically confined to the people in question. The other is saying, well, the people in question are involved in a crime that has a nexus with some things that other people did and so forth.
Well, I don't believe that that statute referred to relating to, which is broader than is or consists of without the modifier relating to, so that's what brings it in. But again, I go back to the point that the Purdue executives agreed as part of their plea agreement and their convictions upon a statement of facts, which is set forth in the joint appendix, and they agreed that they had a responsibility and an obligation to detect fraud, to prevent the misbranding of OxyContin, and to prevent the delivery into interstate commerce of misbranded OxyContin. If they didn't have that responsibility, then we would be talking only about what third parties did, and they might have more of a point to make. But here we're talking about their own failures and their own duties.
They don't concede negligence, do they?
They don't use the word negligence, but from a conceptual standpoint, what they concede is that they had an obligation to prevent or detect fraud as that crime is defined in the park and similar cases, and they didn't. They could have, as a defense, argued that they were powerless to prevent it, but they didn't raise that.
Failing to exercise power you have is different, perhaps only marginally, from negligence.
Right. And so I think it's similar. And it's important to note that this type of criminal, the misbranding laws and the responsible corporate officer doctrine, really reflect the significance to the federal health care programs and to the public of having corporate officials who are in these positions of trust ensure that something like a Schedule II controlled substance is not sold or distributed in a way that violates the laws. And in that respect, I would analogize the Purdue executives to a lifeguard. If you're at a swimming pool and you're the lifeguard, you have a certain amount of duty to ensure that there are no accidents at the pool. If something happens, even though you didn't intend for there to be an accident, you still have a certain degree of responsibility, and your own failure to meet that responsibility, which is what facilitates the accident, and that's what we're saying here, is that their failure
to facilitate. That's not ordinarily a criminal act, though. These criminal statutes, without scienter, related to, I didn't even intend to use that, but relate to activities in which you don't have scienter, but you have a responsible position, are really fairly rare birds. Somewhere in one of the cases cited in the briefs, they said they date back 100 years, but I looked at the 100 years back and it didn't really look like one. Does it at all affect how we should interpret the statute, that it does affect something where there's no scienter required? I think
no.
That's perhaps stretching a little from Mr. Phillips' argument, but not much.
No, Judge Sintel, and I would note that there are other portions of the exclusion statute that do include a equivalent of a scienter requirement, which is such as subsection B16.
Yeah, but the regulations themselves are interpreting this statute.
That's right. I guess my point is that the regulations, the agency's interpretation of the statute does not turn on the presence or absence of scienter, and our view is that given that Congress required scienter for other types of exclusions, that suggests that in this situation it wasn't necessary.
I'm stepping beyond the briefs a little, and that's totally unfair, and I'm going to do it anyway. Does the rule of lenity have anything to do with how we should approach the interpretation of the consequences of a no scienter crime?
We would say no, Your Honor, because this is not a criminal penalty. This is
it's a penal section acting based upon a criminal statute. So that gives rise to my question, and you pointing it out doesn't answer the question for me. Why shouldn't we apply the rule of lenity in that circumstance?
Because this serves a remedial purpose. The statute should be interpreted broadly. There is precedent from other circuits.
Can you tell me what that statute is that doesn't serve a remedial purpose? We get attorneys in here often who argue, well, you should interpret the statute my way because it serves a remedial purpose. presumably Congress meant to remedy something when it passed each of these.
That's true, but under these particular provisions of the statute, we're not imposing a fine. The person
Well, you're doing something to this case much worse than imposing a fine.
There is an exclusion. They have a considerable amount of opportunities to be heard. There's a lot
You're
of
barring
process.
Them from the career at which they've spent their working lives. I'm not saying you shouldn't be. I'm simply saying that this is a matter of seriousness that probably exceeds most of the fines that we see.
That exceeds, I'm sorry, most
the
of the fines?
That we see, yeah. You think if you continue practicing law for another 30 years and we suddenly disbar you, I think you'd rather pay a fine than face that barment. And I think this barment is much like being disbarred to an attorney.
Right, but although they are excluded from this industry, it does not, there was already a holding in their preliminary injunction case that they weren't, this didn't truly end their careers. But even though there is...
I got lost on that one. This is ending their careers. It may be that they're going to be able, even at their age, to start some new career, but this is ending their career. You take 12 years and bar them from the industry they've worked in for a career. I don't see how you can get past the straight face test to say it doesn't end their careers. This is an extremely serious consequence. Now, it may be that it should be. I'm not asking you to concede anything in the case, but does the seriousness of this consequence and the lack of scienter affect the way we should judge the reasonableness of the Secretary's interpretation?
I would say no, Your Honor, because again, I would refer to the fact, the point that you made during appellant's argument, that when you look at the statutory language, it's susceptible to multiple meanings, and this is a statute, although it does exclude people, it is essentially an enforcement power that was delegated to the Secretary, and we believe that if the statute is deemed to be susceptible to multiple meanings, we should receive deference, and that there is not the highly narrow interpretive approach that applies in the immigration context that they cite. And again, just to refer again to the Niwan case, even in the immigration context, where there is precedent indicating that the terms must be interpreted as narrowly as possible, the court still recognized that a circumstance-specific approach could be used to determine whether a offense fell within the category that triggered deportation.
What's the provision for which you're now seeking deference? Interpretation of which you're now seeking deference?
Our primary position is that the ordinary language of the sections B1 and B3 allow the Secretary to consider the plea and the nature of the conviction to determine if there's a relation. Our alternative argument is even if the court finds ambiguity.
What is it about the Secretary's expertise that would possibly justify deferring to her interpretation of terms like misdemeanor? Relating to fraud.
Well, again, that asks the antecedent. There are two questions. Our point is not, we don't believe that this turns on the definition of the word misdemeanor. The question is, what analytical construct did Congress expect the Secretary to apply?
Let's take relating to. What is it about the Secretary's expertise with regard to health care or anything else that justifies deference to her interpretation?
Yes, the Secretary oversees and administers federal health care programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. This exclusion provision, which is part of the Social Security Act, applies in that context and is designed to impose safeguards, and frankly, it imposes incentives.
Well, when you get down to the provision dealing with aggravating and mitigating factors and harm to the program and so on, I can see a little bit of what you're talking about. I don't understand how that applies to B1 or B3.
Our point is that Congress has entrusted the Secretary with, through the Inspector General's office, with deciding in this discretionary exclusion context whether an individual should or should not be excluded. And as part of entrusting that to the Secretary, that is implicitly delegating authority to interpret the circumstances in which that authority attaches. If I could briefly turn to the aggravating.
Well, let me ask you, if it said the Secretary may exclude. Well, I'll leave it at that. Go ahead with your argument.
Okay. If I could briefly turn to the aggravating and mitigating factors, I would note that the Secretary applied two aggravating factors, which are codified in the regulations. We applied one mitigating factor. There's nothing in the statute or the regulations that required the Secretary to consider any other mitigating factors that the executives may wish to have been considered. we believe that they're, if they were ignorant of their subordinate's conduct, that does not qualify as a mental condition that would have a mitigating impact. And as the court noted, the cooperation was considered and applied to mitigate the length of the exclusion. We believe that the criminal proceedings provided substantial evidence, which is sufficient evidence for a reasonable finder of fact to conclude that the aggravating factors were present. There's really no dispute that the misbranding and fraud continued for over 5 years. That's significantly greater than the 1 year baseline in the statute. We believe that the restitution amount, although it may not specify exactly how much loss there was to the government, surely indicates that there was more than $5,000. It's really implausible to assume that a $160 million in restitution would be paid if the actual loss for which any restitution might be due was under a $5,000 threshold.
Are you depending upon that likelihood provision?
We are not. We believe that although the regulations do refer to that, the Secretary is relying on the other portion of the regulation, which refers to actual loss. In sum, the Secretary's decision was a reasonable exercise of her discretion.
After you talked about aggravating factors, the next thing it seems to me that came up in the decision under review was getting from there to 12 years of exclusion.
Yes.
Right? And here we have the DAB saying, let's see, this is at 653 in the appendix. In reviewing whether the length of exclusion is unreasonable, the ALJ may not substitute his judgment for that of the IG or determine what period of exclusion would be better. Instead, the ALJ is limited to considering whether the period of exclusion imposed by the IG was within a reasonable range based on demonstrated criteria. The preamble to Part 1001 indicates the IG has, quote, broad discretion, close quote, in setting the length of an exclusion in a particular case. Now, this opinion goes on to say that the 15 years was not unprecedented.
Right?
There are several other instances in which individuals were excluded for 14, 15 years. What is the role of precedent in the board's decision making?
The board believes that that the length of the exclusion is case specific. It requires assessing the weight of the aggravating factors that were present. So you can't really say that this case involved a misdemeanor and was 10 years, and this other case involved.
Why can't you? I don't understand. I mean, that's in all these quote tests that the Supreme Court devises, which it says are to be taken into account all the facts and circumstances. That's exactly what happens. It may not be a very artful process, but that's how, for example, search and seizure law operates.
There are two answers to that, Judge Williams. The first is that the board believes and has indicated the Secretary indicated when the regulations were passed that this would be a weighing. There's not a specific formula tied to aggravating and mitigating factors. The second answer.
But that doesn't preclude consideration, careful consideration of previous acts and some effort to create a coherent pattern.
That's true, Your Honor, and that goes to my second answer, which is that the board did consider past exclusions, and I would also like to respond.
Referring to the Smith and Posner and all those other cases?
There are, but there are other cases that I would like to point out.
But the board relied on that set, right?
The board did rely on that
61.
Set. I would just like to note that the appellant's contention that this is the longest discretionary exclusion is untrue. There are prior exclusion decisions that are longer than 12 years for B1 and other discretionary exclusions.
Here's what the board said at 661. There is ample precedent for lengthy exclusions, right? And then it cites Smith, Posner, Gale, Robinson, and Battle. Indicating parenthetically how many years were involved in each one, but nothing about what the facts were in those cases that warranted the 15 years. I'm not, so I don't see how one can get from the fact that there have been previously long sentences, or exclusions rather, to the idea that they're warranted in this case.
Well, I believe that passage was responding to the executive's argument below, as they argue here, that this was an exclusion of unprecedented length. The board's primary point was that the weight significance.
No, that, here's what it said. The paragraph begins at stop of 661, and this is what the is responding to, the opinions. Petitioners also argue that the length of their exclusions unreasonably exceeds those imposed in far more egregious cases. And then were cited cases showing that as much as 15 years has been meted out before, but nothing about whether those were as or more egregious cases.
Right, and it's my understanding that those cases, which are, I believe at least some of them are cited in our briefs, and they are all available on Westlaw, that the circumstances are reflected in the opinions, and the opinions, they are minor. To be frank, Your Honor,
I'm sure the circumstances are in those opinions, but the question is whether the board is acting, whether this is illogical without its reasoning through whether those were egregious cases, as egregious cases, or more egregious cases, rather.
No, it's not illogical to cite the case and make the point without providing a detailed parenthetical. The cases themselves pale in comparison to what
was at issue. All cases in which somebody was convicted of a fraud implemented by murdering an HHS employee, and they got 15 years of exclusion for that. Wouldn't that suggest that it might be disproportionate to put 15 years to the facts of this case?
It's fact specific. We don't believe that the court should substitute its assessment, but I would also note that that's not what these cases.
In the same sense that the common law is fact specific, right? But we draw upon precedents and try to maintain some consistency and coherence.
No, but here there's an element of discretion, and this really gets to a reviewability question that comes up frequently in agency review cases, which is that there is no formula. The agency has discretion to decide what the period is appropriate.
Well, are you saying the discretion is incapable of abuse?
I'm saying that
it's discretion, end of topic, or can that be a discretion be abused?
No, my point is that failing to provide detailed parentheticals for each case that's cited in an opinion is not an abuse of discretion.
This case arose on a Wednesday, and I'm always grumpy on Wednesday, so I'm going to double the sentence from what I would otherwise impose on you, said the ALJ. What is our standard for reviewing that?
Well, that would not, the fact that it's Wednesday is not an aggravating factor, and so if the board were to apply that type of rationale. it would be subject to reversal for violating the law.
There's an aggravating factor here, so I'm going to give you more than 3 years of exclusion. Ordinarily, I would give 6, but because it's Wednesday, I'm going to give 12.
Well, that wouldn't be consistent with what the board has said, that we look at the weight of the factors, and the board indicates here that the magnitude of the loss and the magnitude of the duration of conduct and, frankly, the magnitude of the fraud itself warranted a significant increase in the length of the exclusion. We're not saying that the board picked 12 years out of the air, nor are we asking the court to authorize the board to always do that.
I don't see anything other than the air surrounding the 12 years. But that may be immaterial if we can't review for abuse of discretion. I'm trying to get straight what your position is.
Our position is that there is not review of whether the board applied the aggravating factors and interpreted the regulations and acted consistently with the statute. We don't believe that the standard of review under Section 405G allows the court to go into the actual number that was selected. But if the manner of selecting the number doesn't comply with the regulations, which here set forth certain aggravating and mitigating factors, then the court could certainly review that. Our point is that here that didn't happen.
But here, the passage that Judge Ginsburg has been looking at said 12 years is a reasonable period of exclusion. So the aggravating and mitigating factors have all been dealt with. Now we're just in reasonableness. Is it your position that's completely unreviewable?
By this court, yes, and I would refer only because this is not a case that arises under the Administrative Procedure Act, and there is not arbitrary and capriciousness review. If the agency's regulations have...
The agency is entitled to be completely unreasonable. Is that, I just want to get it clear.
No, our point is that the agency is entitled to apply aggravating factors and to weigh those factors. The regulations require that. Yep. But how the weight is calculated is not reviewable, is our position. But we would note that the cases that are cited here indicate that even if it were reviewable, this is not disproportionate, this is not out of line. And I would also note that this
is... What if they appear not to be weighed? You rest on the proposition that they were weighed, but it isn't evident that they were weighed.
I'm sorry.
The passages that Judge Ginsburg directed your attention to suggest an approach in which what more normal people, I think, would think of as very important variables are simply disregarded. In other words, a precedent is considered sufficient, at least, perhaps controlling, if it involves a large number without regard to facts and circumstances.
That's I fundamentally disagree with that characterization of the ruling. First, I would direct the court's attention to the prior page, which is page 660 of the joint appendix, which discusses the reasonableness, and the board notes that the aggravating factors are significant in terms of their duration and the cost they impose. They had effects that exceed the thresholds many times over, and notes the astronomical costs, and they also discuss in the next paragraphs the seriousness of the offense. That reflects really a weighing of the magnitude of the aggravating factors that were present here. The later paragraph, which also discusses past precedent in response to the notion that's incorrect, that this is an unprecedented exclusion, simply indicates, and by the way, we've done things similar to this before, this is not out of line, and I would also note this is not out of line.
Similar in duration, right? That's all we know.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. At 6:53, where we were earlier, the board went on to say, the preamble to Part 1001 indicates that the IG has, quote, broad discretion, close quote. This is the first paragraph. In setting the length of an exclusion in a particular case, based on the IG's, quote, vast experience, close quote, in implementing exclusions. Is there any indication that the IG conformed to that authorization by basing the particular length on his or her vast experience?
Yes, the IG has considerable experience. Honestly, Your Honor, there are many exclusion cases that do not, let alone do they not reach the federal appellate court level. Mm-hmm. They don't even go to the ALJ or to the Departmental Appeals Board. And the agency is well-versed in applying its aggravating and mitigating factors. It was dealing with an unusual circumstance here, the magnitude of which can hardly be overstated, and that's why...
I want to take you back just for a moment to the standard of review discussion. I understand your position with the brief that this incorporates the standard of review from 405G that precludes application of any other standard than based on substantial evidence in the record, or that exclusion would include the APA application, right?
That's correct, okay. Your Honor.
Thank you. So we are governed by the adoption of 405G.
That's correct. And under that standard, the question is, was there substantial evidence?
By the way, is on page 14 of your brief rather than 13. So if Judge Williams is looking for it in the table of authorities, he will not find it in the right place.
Thank you, Your Honor. And our position on standard of review is that is there substantial evidence? Did we comply with the statute and the regulations? We submit that we did. We would ask this court to affirm the district court's decision, which affirmed the Department of Appeals Board ruling.
Substantial evidence standard here, same as the one in Universal Camera that governs the Labor Board, correct?
The substantial evidence standard is there evidence from which a reasonable finder of fact could find the presence of what ultimately is concluded to exist.
Well, we do require the Labor Board to show consistency, if somebody points out that it seems to be inconsistent with its prior decisions in a way that it doesn't acknowledge, we do regard that as undermining what would otherwise be perhaps substantial evidence, right?
My recollection of that line of cases is that falls more from the APA standard of review, which deals with arbitrariness and capricious and not explaining departures from past precedent. And again, we would note that the board did not deviate from its past precedent in this case, and that all of the cases cited in the decision support the exclusion and the application of aggravating factors.
We've talked you well past your allotted time, so unless my colleagues have further questions, thank you, counsel. And
thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal from the appellant. We talked into the last minute, but we'll give you two for rebuttal, Mr. Phillips.
I appreciate that, Judge Santel. I would like to address each of the three points that the members of the panel have addressed. First, Judge Williams, with respect to the arcane nature of the way the statutory provision is written, it seems to me that my esteemed colleague on the other side essentially did nothing more than to essentially eliminate those portions of the statute which were inconvenient and simply said that we failed to prevent a fraud. And if that were what the statute said, we would have a different issue here. But it seems to me that this language, talking about something that consists of a misdemeanor, focuses on the nature of the crime. You asked specifically, isn't this the kind of crime that Congress must have had in mind? I think it's worth recognizing that Title 42 contains a whole slew of programs involving misdemeanors that have scienter and false statements as part of those criminal offenses. So the idea that this was the one item that Congress would have had is quite improbable. Indeed, they had a whole slew of them. What makes this one quite different, candidly, is the utter absence of knowledge or willfulness or any notion of scienter. And that ought to be a fundamental basis for the court to say we draw the line here and no different. Judge Santel, you asked about the rule of lenity. It seems to me that this is a case in which the court ought to be looking for a clear statement of some form from Congress, in part because the nature of the penalty is extraordinary, in part because the nature of the criminal responsibility is so minimalist. And we're talking about the corporate responsibility doctrine. And the reason why Congress says you can go down this road, and the reason the court upheld it in the first instance, is because it's supposed to be a minor offense, not one that brings an end to somebody's professional life in the way that it did here.
Minor offense, it does carry the potential for incarceration, does it not?
Oh, to be sure. Yeah. It carries the potential of incarceration.
Minor relative to a felony, but still.
But the notion that you'd go beyond what the U.S. attorney and everybody negotiated to eventually impose the death penalty seems completely inappropriate.
Well, that apparently didn't come on the table at the time of the negotiations. If it did, it was laid aside for another day.
Right.
I don't think that gets you anywhere, that it's not in the plea bargain.
No, I had to be sure.
It's not there from your side either.
Right, right. But the question is it reasonable to assume that Congress, under these circumstances, meant to allow this kind of a regime to be heaped on at the back end? And that, it seems to me, goes to Judge Ginsburg's point, which is this a place where you can just simply say that this is a call that is completely left to the unbridled discretion of the agency. And Butler versus Bernhard is a 405G case decided by this court that says it's not a matter of you just get to put in parentheses, oh, sure, we've stuck other people with something that's as bad as this without any analysis of whether their conduct remotely comes close to what's at issue in this particular case.
You don't have a precedent, though, where we've required the secretary to, or anybody else has, required the secretary to give a detailed analysis of all the prior cases in order to enter a suspension on this case.
No, but I think it would be quite reasonable to insist on the agency identifying a case that comes within an order of magnitude of the conduct involved in this case. We're talking four times.
Sounds awfully specific for something that is a review of the discretion, exercise of discretion.
And see, Judge Santel, it seems to me that if this statutory scheme allows that kind of unreviewable discretion with that kind of consequence attached to it, you ought to resolve the issue of whether or not the regulation allows you to go down this road by requiring acts for aggravation, and you ought to read the statute to say, unless it's the kind of misdemeanor offense that has a true nexus to fraud, it's not actionable, period.
In terms of order of magnitude, the cases, the amounts involved in this case dwarf anything in the prior cases.
In terms of the size of the exclusion?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
No, I'm sorry.
No.
The financial
settlements
with the company,
right,
the volume
of the
commerce
company
involved.
Yeah.
But
that's all the company. And to be sure, I mean,
these were responsible executives of the company. I mean,
of course.
I know we're talking about no scienter crime, but this is five years long and $160 million that was.
Right, but Judge Santel, the U.S. attorney testified before Congress in the record in this case. He looked at all those documents. They looked at all the witness interviews. There's no evidence of knowledge by these three individuals. To be sure, they assumed responsibility as corporate officers.
Yeah, they did, and that's required of them by law, and in a case involving controlled substance, lawful distribution of controlled substances,
right, but
that's not unreasonable to require a high degree of attention to detail, is it?
I have no doubt about the propriety of the corporate responsibility doctrine. The question is, when you deal with a situation where that doctrine leads you to a misdemeanor offense, is it appropriate then to go this extra distance where Congress did not state clearly that's what its intent was, and where the effect of it is in these circumstances is wildly out of sync with anything when you examine the individual's conduct as opposed to the corporation's conduct? There are no further questions. I urge the court to reverse.
The case will be submitted. Give us recess.